welcome to Microbyte. My name is Gavin Clark. I'm the software editor for The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, the editor of the ZDNet blog, all about Microsoft.
This month, we get the chance to fly down to Vegas, not for the slots or the Mexican dudes hanging out on street corners, hanging out flyers for porn, but for Mix, Microsoft's annual conference for developers and designers. Well, we thought it'd be a good idea to look at what's coming up in that show, and we're going to take a trip around some like really interesting new technologies that are coming out from Microsoft. We're going to see what's coming in SQL Server and the Azure Cloud, and some promises Microsoft made there to put SQL Server into Azure. We're going to look at the next version of SilverLight 3, which I know a lot of people have been getting very excited about. And also, we're going to take a look at Internet Explorer 8, which every indication is going to release to manufacturing later this month, quite probably at Mix as well. And we're going to take a look at Windows 7, brace for inaction on that front. And then TomTom, a case too far. What's really going on there? Microsoft's legal action against the navigation systems company. Really interesting stuff on that front. So, MJ, I thought we'd kick off with taking a look at Mix and what's coming there. And there's some really interesting stuff bubbling around putting SQL Server into the cloud. I don't know what you kind of thought about some of that.
Yeah, Gavin, you had some really interesting information on that from a conference you were at, I think MSDN conference, right?
That was it, yeah.
Yeah. It's been funny to watch the reaction about your story, where basically you said Microsoft's pretty much going back to the drawing board with SQL Data Services. I never can keep the name of that one straight. Used to be SQL Server Data Services. Now it's SQL Data Services.
Yes.
Your story was interesting because up until now, Microsoft's been talking about SQL Data Services more like a Amazon SimpleDB. Like it's not a real database hosted in the cloud, but more like database kind of services, but not a full-fledged database. But based on what you were told, it seems like Microsoft's going back to the drawing board and rethinking that, and they're going to make SQL Data Services more like a version of SQL Server hosted in the cloud.
Yeah.
That's interesting to me because that's what Amazon's doing, pretty much.
The guy who I spoke to at Microsoft, who was a Microsoft evangelist, he didn't go into a lot of details, and you know that was obvious. Obviously, going to raise a lot more questions than the answers that it gave. But I spoke to a lot of partners, and the impression I'm getting is that currently, as you have it, SDS gives you an instance of SQL Server and a web services interface. That's one set of storage that you get in Microsoft Azure Cloud. And then there's a second bucket of storage in the Azure Cloud, which has alternative names, but you know, Azure Table Services or just Azure Storage is different names are being kicked around. From what I'm picking up, Microsoft has written its own storage engine. So that is not an actual instance of SQL Server or SQL Server technology. In fact, it's not even relational. And the impression I'm getting from speaking to a lot of partners who are close to the subject is you won't be doing any relational programming when it comes to the actual Azure storage stuff. You're going to have to learn how to program or go back to program applications when people were building mainframes or VAX systems, which is going to create a lot of challenges for people, I think.
Yeah, you know what I think, and I learned about some of this when I was writing recently a series that I did on my blog about Red Dog and Microsoft's whole thinking about the cloud operating system. What's very confusing is there's two database layers in Microsoft's Azure platform, and one of those is what you're talking about, which is the storage layer down at the very base of the operating system. And that's the thing that we've heard with a lot of different code names, like Cosmos was one of the code names, and it was kind of amorphous what that was until Microsoft unveiled all of Red Dog, and then it turned out that this data piece was one of the four pillars of the operating system. But then if you go up a layer and up a level, there's SQL Data Services. And that's more like a database on top of a bucket where you can store data. I've been looking at the session list for Mix, and I noticed that Microsoft seems as though they're going to talk more about some of the Azure layers and maybe explain what we're hung up on here about a little bit better, where they're going to distinguish more between the actual operating system database type component, which is more like a file system almost. There's a guy named Brad Calder who's in charge of that, and he's one of the mixed speakers. And then they're going to talk about the higher level layers, of which SQL Data Services is one, where developers would interact more with that level than they would going all the way down the stack to the operating system. So hopefully they're going to clear some of this up at Mix.
I think one of the things they've been getting a lot of stick over is just the basic level of lack of functionality in the current service that you get through Azure or SDS. For example, just you can't change certain features, you can't rename metadata without dumping it. There's some real fundamental usability issues which Microsoft hasn't put into the system as yet, and that's probably understandable because it's so new and they're still testing out the scalability of the system, so they didn't want to pack it in with lots of different features. But it sounds like you should expect to see some bread and butter SQL Server type database functionality going in there that won't necessarily make it a relational database, but will make it more usable to people who just want to use a database. So in terms of just sheer ordinary functionality, programming, setting up, deleting, really basic functionality and features.
That's good. What I'm going to be interested in too is if they talk timing, because they've been reiterating lately that Azure is going to be out in the second half of this year, probably around the time of the PDC in November. But if you try to pin them on which parts of Azure do you mean? Do you mean the operating system? Do you mean the SQL layer? Do you mean all of the programming technologies that are part of it, or what? They won't really get that granular yet. But I'm thinking, with this kind of reset in course with SQL Data Services, that piece is going to be lagging somewhat, or at least parts of it will be behind the rest of the platform.
Right, and I also wouldn't be at all surprised if you see some expanded storage capacity. Currently, there's a limit on the number of blob entries you can have. You can only run 2 megabytes and 100 megabytes, different sizes and different containers, like only 1,000 containers. It's really tightly controlled, again, because it's a trial system. I've got to think they've done their early testing, and now they're going to want to take it wider and let people put more storage in these systems. So I wouldn't be surprised we see the storage limit increased for early adopters at Mix.
Yeah, maybe we'll see a new CTP of the .NET services or something like that too.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting looking down the session list here for what else they're going to talk about. The other, I'd say, two biggest themes besides some of these Azure services are ASP.NET. There's 14 sessions on that at Mix, and then there's 30 sessions mentioning Silverlight. So we already know to some degree Silverlight's going to be a big theme, and obviously Silverlight 3 is going to be a big topic. But I'm kind of fuzzy, beyond just reciting a lengthy feature list of things they're fixing and updating what they're going to say about Silverlight. Do you have more of a sense?
I think it's very interesting that there's a dominant mantra coming out of Redmond that this is going to be big. Scott Guthrie was saying it's going to be a major improvement. It's going to take Silverlight in new directions. And everyone who's gone up there, including partners and people we know in the industry have gone up there, they go up there, they come back and they go, it's going to be brilliant, but they'll never tell you what.
So I saw Miguel's discuss said that, like, I can't, I'd love to tell you, but I can't, or they'll kill me. So
I wonder, it got me thinking, what does this really mean? And I get the impression it's going to be big, but in a relative sense. Look at where Silverlight is right now. It's great for media streaming, media and video. It's given the .NET developers a lot to play with. It's brought native video to their own platform. It means they don't have to mess around with Flash anymore. And that's a great, great innovation for them. But once you start digging deeper, you'll find there's a lot of holes in there. There's a lot of bread and butter functionality. Again, that word, bread and butter, that are lacking in the rival Flash platform. And so piecing together, I think what you should expect to see from Microsoft at Mix in terms of Silverlight 3 are basic features that are going to finally put Silverlight on a par with Flash in terms of forward buttons, backward buttons, the ability to support printing, the ability to provide support for TIFF and GIF. These are real features that developers in all the forums have been crying out for. I got to think you're going to finally see them close the loop on that, and then at last Microsoft's got a kind of a more realistic alternative to Flash. So again, it's not like it's going to take Flash in a brilliant unthought of direction. It's just, sorry, Silverlight in a brilliant unthought of direction, but it is going to give parity with Flash, which is going to be a major step forward for that for Microsoft's platform. And another thing, sorry, go on.
Sorry, I was going to say one thing I noticed. They're finally figuring out that journalists like us tend to go through the session list and like look and see like, oh yeah, they're going to announce this, this, and this. So they're being a little cagier, I've noticed, and saying, we're not going to put up the guts of this talk until after Mix begins. But a couple of those are interesting. One hints that they're going to talk more about line of business apps and Silverlight. And another one kind of hinted to me that they might be talking about how Silverlight capabilities can be carried over into offline apps and how that's going to work. Silverlight is going to work in conjunction with WPF on the desktop. And I think that'll be really interesting for developers who've kind of felt like those two things, even though they came from the same core, WPF and Silverlight, are going to start actually playing better together and having more synergy together.
Definitely. I think the WPF aspect is really important. And that brings me on to the next point, which I was going to make, which is why this is so important. Again, it's going to Silverlight is going to be important in the Microsoft world, not necessarily for those outside of the Microsoft world. And it's going to be important for one major constituency, a group of people in that Microsoft world, and that's the partners, especially those trying to build interfaces to Microsoft apps. You've had to use, you know, like COM, DCOM, Windows Forms, ASP.NET, or even worse, Flash. Because from what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing is that you're going to finally see some links to WPF and interfaces to model view controllers that are going to really simplify the way those Windows developers can build rich interfaces to their existing Windows applications. I mean, you see companies already setting out their stall in this area, companies like Infragistics. And another thing I think you've got to look out for is deep linking. You're going to see hypertext links put into content that's built using Silverlight 3 that will suddenly let you make it easier to serve up Silverlight content into search engines, making that easier to find, and then also let you embed Silverlight 3 apps, just the video, into another page. So all these things are like a little pushing forward on many fronts. But I think it's going to really help the case of the partners in terms of using Silverlight and then getting their customers to adopt Silverlight within their own organization as opposed to defaulting to Flash all the time.
Very interesting. Should we go on to IE, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. Now, you had some interesting observations on IEA, didn't you? I mean, there's some news coming up there, you think?
Yeah, and again, this is a place I think at Mix we're probably going to be hearing more about IE8. I'm kind of leaning toward thinking that Internet Explorer 8 might RTM or at least be released to the web the same week as Mix, given that one of the keynoters at Mix is the guy who's the general manager of the IE team, Dean Hakimovich.
Yeah.
So it's about time for them to release IE8, even though I've written about, and I think you have too, Gavin, a lot of the compatibility issues that are still hugely problematic for IE8. They're not going to change the code at this point, and they're publishing lists of at least, I think I had a list of 2,000-plus websites that are still not compatible. And these are major websites, not like little piddly websites. These are big ones like CNN that still aren't working correctly with IE8 when standards mode is set as a default, which is what the default is in IE8. So, you know, it's gonna be a pretty big deal, I think, because for beta testers, we know, I'm one of the beta testers for IE8, and we know to expect that a lot of things are going to break, and we understand why things are breaking. But I think when the general public gets their hands on this, and a lot of websites and pages they go to don't work anymore, there's going to be a real outcry.
What kind of things, how they're breaking? Is it just the pages aren't displaying properly? And why is that? Because this compatibility list is surely supposed to address some of these issues.
Yeah, the compatibility list goes a long way to helping to fix this. And so the way that works is if you have a website that's on that list and you agree to allow that list to be downloaded to your computer, when you hit one of those websites, it automatically is not going to display in compatibility mode. I mean, I'm sorry, in standards mode, which is the default for IE8. So it'll look right to you, even though it won't be displaying in a standards mode way. Mm-hmm. So it's like self-correcting. But you know, what Microsoft did with IE8, and everybody knows in theory they're doing this, but I don't think they really understand in practice what this means is, with IE8, standards mode becomes the default. But people who've coded their websites in the past for IE have not coded to comply with standards because Microsoft wasn't building IE to be a standards-based browser until now. So, you know, people who've built their pages so they look right with IE6 and IE7, a lot of times when you go to those pages with IE8, either you don't see a lot of the text, the sites don't load, there's big chunks of stuff missing off the pages. And if you've been to the site before, you know that it's looking wrong and it's messed up. And if you've never been to the site, you might just think, wow, this site's awful. It's like missing half the text, you know? So it's going to be kind of crazy when, you know, everyday users start getting IE8 and they're like, wow, like all these websites look horrible. And then if they happen to use another browser like Chrome or Safari or Firefox and they go to the same site, they're like, hey, wait a second. Like, this is really messed up. So I think what's going to happen is IE8 is going to lose more market share over this.
I think you're right. I think Microsoft's always had to compete against itself. And it was interesting to note that Internet Explorer 7 only just managed to crawl past IE6 last summer in terms of market share. And it's five years more advanced in terms of the features that it contains. But that's a comment on the simple inertia that it takes for Explorer to get adopted in the market. I think Microsoft, with this solution, it was a step in the right direction. But as you say, it's going to put hurdles in the way to its adoption. And I think it's going to be possibly even longer. It's going to take even longer for Internet Explorer 8 to get usage in the market on a broad scale than it took IE7.
Yep. You know, it's funny. Microsoft's in a really tough spot here because they're doing what's right. They're finally making IE compliant with web-based standards. That's the correct thing they should be doing. But the path to getting there is going to be so painful because everybody who's developed their websites in the past to work around with all these weird things that IE does are going to have to go and undo all that. Yeah. And so, you know, Microsoft's trying to kind of hold people's feet to the fire by publishing this list and saying you can only get off the list if you go back and recode your site so it works correctly with IE8. Okay, they kind of have to do that, but even though they do have to do that, it's going to be a real rough, like, year, 2 years till people start actually going that route and going back in and recoding sites.
I think there's a definite case here of the very sites Microsoft wants using be coded for Internet Explorer 8 are really going to hold off. They're going to want to see some adoption, real-life adoption in the market before they start recoding their sites to work with this new browser. And they're going to be thinking twice, particularly as you've got Firefox doing rollout there, and then you've got Google Chrome bobbing around as well. They're going to like suddenly there's no reason for them to default to the next version of Internet Explorer as it has been in years past.
Yeah, I don't know if you've had a chance to download the new Safari beta for Windows. I am a total non-Apple fan, and everybody who knows me knows that. But man, that's a great browser. I was stunned. I really didn't want to try it, but everybody kept saying to me, "Try it. It's so fast." And so I downloaded it on top of Windows 7, which isn't even one of the supported operating systems for it, and that thing just screams. Yeah. It's unbelievable. It's even faster than Chrome. Right. I mean, the thing is incredibly fast. So, you know, Microsoft's really got its competition cut out for it now. You know, it's not just automatically going to be an IE versus Firefox world out there. There's a lot of other really decent browsers that are coming on strong.
Well, I spoke to one Microsoft partner who actually said there's actually another angle to Internet Explorer 8 that's going to hold up. He said there's just too many surfaces. When you look at something like Firefox or Safari or even Chrome, it's very easy to find your way around there. Where you look at something like Internet Explorer and even particularly version 8, you can see where every product group and every feature group has got its little feature in there, and that's created more areas for the user to click, and it's created more confusion. It's going to create more confusion for them.
Yep, I agree with that. There's a lot of features in IE8. I mean, I actually kind of like IE8. I am an Internet Explorer user, and so I'm really comfortable in that environment. But I'm still kind of at a loss to get web slices and accelerators. I just don't really see why I would use those things. And like you're saying, every little group wants to have their say and add their little feature in instead of just having a really slimmed down, tight, small, you know, very easily downloadable browser. You've got everything but the kitchen sink in there. Yeah. You know, so you know, there's a whole other set of issues around IE that we haven't even touched on yet that are going to have a really detrimental effect potentially on the new browser, and that's around the legal issues and the antitrust issues. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that Microsoft's plan as of now is to make IE 8 the built-in default web browser with Windows 7 when Windows 7 comes out. But over in Europe, Opera has filed an antitrust suit against Microsoft where it's trying to prove that Microsoft's policy over the years of preloading Internet Explorer and making it part of the operating system has hurt consumer choice. And Mozilla is now part of that complaint alongside with Opera, and Google has petitioned to join as another third party interested in the case. The European Commission has already issued its statement on this, and it's making it look like they're going to come down hard on Microsoft on this. Mm-hmm. Yep. What's interesting now is, you know, a lot of people are like, oh no, you know, so what's going to happen to Windows 7? And Microsoft's just heading for a collision course with the EC. But it turns out a couple of bloggers who have a build of Windows 7, the 7048 build, which they issued privately to a handful of testers after the beta, they've been kind of tinkering around in there and looking what's in there. And lo and behold, one of the things in there is the ability to remove Internet Explorer.
Right.
So Microsoft, you know, they're not just sitting around waiting for the EC to crack on them. They're already looking into, like, okay, if push comes to shove and they make us do this, can we do it without really, you know, derailing Windows 7 and really pushing it way back and having to go back to the drawing board and fix it? So it's been a big source of controversy lately because, you know, some people said Microsoft shouldn't do that, that they're basically showing that they agree with the EC and with Opera and that they're agreeing that the browser should be separate and that they shouldn't do that. Other people are saying they're smart. It's their plan B, and at least then they won't be completely derailed if the court goes after them.
Yeah, I think they've had so many problems in recent years in terms of getting Windows out in the market with Windows Vista that they don't need some kind of legal kind of like hurdle getting in the way in terms of, you know, bundling or not bundling to Internet Explorer 8. It was interesting, I spoke to Opera CEO a little while back, and he was saying that they have actually participated in talks with the EU about actual solutions to this perceived problem. So it's not like we're still at the legal finding out facts case. The legal train is rolling, and there is going to be a solution of some kind. It's just a matter of whether Microsoft wants to have its input taken into that solution, or whether it wants the rivals, the competition, to dictate the shape of that solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they could kind of be proactive and say, "Okay, look, we took it out, so case over, right?"
Yeah,
because, you know, it's interesting, I found this very interesting when I asked Opera what they would propose to the court as their favored course of action. They didn't want Microsoft to be forced to take IE out of Windows.
Yeah.
And their reasoning was, well, they can't take it totally out of Windows because then there'd be no way to download any other browsers because you couldn't get on the Internet. Good point. but, you know, what they did want, and these are two things that Microsoft is trying to fight, and they don't want this to happen, is one potential thing they are petitioning for is to force Microsoft to preload other vendors' browsers with Windows. So when you get the Windows DVD, you not only get Internet Explorer as part of it, but you also get, you know, maybe Chrome, Android, and Opera, and Firefox. And Microsoft really does not want to do that. They're like, why should we be distributing our competitors' products for free?
Yeah.
The other choice that Opera had, and this is one Microsoft hates even more, is that the court forced Microsoft to use Windows Update, its own patching mechanism, to push third-party browsers to users. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft's like, okay, look, you know, this is our patching mechanism. We pay for it. They're our servers, and we're not going to distribute Firefox on our servers. So it's a tough spot, you know?
It's a tough spot, and unfortunately, when you own a monopoly, you've got to face facts that you have to let people inside and play in that monopoly. That's a lesson telcos have learned in Europe. You might own the infrastructure, but you have to throw open the doors to the competition to play on your infrastructure sometimes.
Yep, and you know, again, when I first heard about Opera's case, when they first filed this complaint back in late 2007, I was just kind of like, well, You know, the U.S. courts have already kind of allowed this to happen. I mean, this whole idea, should IE be allowed to be considered part of the operating system? This was a big piece of the U.S. Department of Justice versus Microsoft case like a decade ago. And so the fact that Microsoft continued to be allowed to do that has kind of set the precedent. And, you know, if you look at now what they do with Internet Explorer in Windows, especially like in Windows 7, it's not just the browsers tacked on to the operating system. What they do is they take the rendering engine of the browser and they actually wrap a lot of stuff that's in Windows around that. So you can't just pull the browser out without wrecking everything else at this point. So it's smart on Microsoft's part. They've really inextricably tied the browser into the operating system, and you can't just take it out. You can't just say, okay, it's out. You know,
Microsoft does like the calls, doesn't it? Another legal issue that it's facing is with GPS car navigation company TomTom, and they got a lot of people upset recently with the fact that it's now filing an IP action in the US courts against that company for alleged violation of its Linux in some of its navigation devices. TomTom, of course, runs its own version of Linux. It's not entirely clear what the crux of the case is. There's a lot of dimensions to it. But it seems to be the way TomTom's Linux uses an implementation of FAT to add file system to support for long and short file names, and to manage flash and to manage connection devices actually in its TomTom navigation devices. And it's not clear whether TomTom either misused Microsoft's patent of FAT or whether it used a third-party, non-Microsoft version of FAT. That seems to be, to me, what the case is about, and a lot of people seized on recently. And as predictably, a lot of people got upset in the community. You know, the tone was, here goes Microsoft, you know, this is the case we knew was coming. A lot of Microsoft cynics said, yeah, we told you so, you can't trust the company. MJ, I wondered what you thought. We know Microsoft's been trying to dance with open source for quite a while, but you know, what does this case say about its relationship with the open source community?
You know, it's funny. I had this conversation recently with Microsoft where I said, it's lucky when you guys did that Red Hat deal that you did recently that Steve Ballmer was busy off in Europe or something, and he couldn't undo all the good publicity you guys got for doing that deal around virtualization cross-licensing with Red Hat. Because Microsoft's whole story, when you think about them and open source, is basically one step forward and two steps back to me. They do something great. Everybody's like, yay, wow, maybe they're changing. And then something happens, like, you know, even sometimes the same day or a day later, and you're like, no, that's really still the same old Microsoft, right? And I feel like TomTom was kind of that. It's like they, you know, they were riding high on all this great interoperability goodness they had with Red Hat. And then the next week, or maybe even the same week, I can't remember now, but Microsoft goes and sues TomTom, and three of the eight patents that are involved in the suit involve Linux. Yeah. And so, you know, Microsoft kept saying over and over when all of us were asking them for comment on the case, it's not about Linux. It's not about Linux. Well, okay, so what part of this isn't true? Well, it is partially about Linux. Mm-hmm. And FAT, like you're saying, the file allocation table patent and how that makes use of anything that Microsoft has in the patent space is the issue. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting. I was just reading something new on this this week. Where you know, a lot of people have been having interviews with Horacio Gutierrez, who's the Microsoft corporate VP in charge of intellectual property, and he's the guy who always is trotted out whenever Microsoft has a patent issue, especially in the Linux and open source area. And I think it was it's Computer World that I was reading this, where Horacio Gutierrez, they kind of pinned him and said, okay, the real problem here is FAT, right? Mm-hmm. And you guys are mad that TomTom won't license FAT from you. And mm-hmm. and they got him to say, yeah, you know, we got Kenwood, we got Alpine, we got Pioneer. We got a bunch of other people who are Linux companies or have Linux involvement to agree to license our patents, and TomTom wouldn't in this area. Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of like he admitted it, basically. Like, yeah, we're trying to make TomTom license our FAT patent and make sure that that's the version they use in the Linux part of their GPS system. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's also kind of ironic that for people who followed Microsoft for a while, if you remember, Gutierrez is the guy who's very famous for having said Linux and open source violate 235 Microsoft patents. This is the guy. So, you know, already he's kind of working with not the best reputation out there among open source vendors. Now he's also the guy they're trotting out there saying, and we're going to sue TomTom. And here's Horatio.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. The Linux people are pretty focused on this. I mean, rightly they point out that these cases can be very protracted and also can focus down to a number of key issues, and you have to get down to the facts. But I spoke to Jim Zemlin, the executive director of the Linux Foundation, and he put out a statement, and he basically said, look, listen, people, calm down. This isn't a broad-fronted attack on Linux. It's one case. It's Microsoft and TomTom. But on the other hand, he also said Linux Foundation is watching this situation, be ready to mount a defense of Linux if it came to it. So, you know, people are watching this case, and as you say, you know, Microsoft's strategy is not to attack Linux in broadly, but to go about tying off patent licensing agreements everywhere, as it did with the companies you mentioned, and you know, as it did with Novell, and obviously it tried to do Red Hat, but failed.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and you know, to your point. All you really need is one case, right? It's like they may not be attacking all of the companies in open source or all open source vendors or all Linux vendors, but you know, everyone knew at some point there was going to be a case where this came up and this happened. And I feel like this is the first case. And you know, Microsoft may want to go on the record saying it's not about Linux, but at least in part it is about Linux.
So MJ, it's time for our for the Todd Bishop painted Bummer Mood Index, and just recap the options. We've got frustrated and intense, all business, victorious, and monkey beer. Monkey beer. Monkey beer. Or monkey beer. So is what mood's Bummer in this week, do you reckon, MJ?
I would say he's in quite a somber mood, given I'm looking at Microsoft's stock price right now, and it's $15 and change. I mean, people were complaining when it was $28, right? And now, due to the economy and Microsoft admitting in all of their recent appearances that customers are strapped and IT users and consumers both are not buying, I think Bummer is feeling pretty somber right now.
Yeah.
So I'd say definitely all business, and just trying to figure out, like, wow, how are we going to weather this recession?
Yeah. I think it was interesting also, he was at the MVP conference recently, and you know, if Microsoft loves anyone more than developers, it's the MVPs. But he got hauled over the course slightly on the mobile strategy, I saw from one questioner, and he was forced to say, yeah, you know, we've got a significant release coming, but it's not the release we wanted. So there's a few kind of like dark clouds in that Microsoft horizon right now. So I'd go, yeah, I say he's probably a bit intense or all business right now.
Yep, I'd agree. Yep.
Time for that monkey beer.
Free as in beer, right?
Free as in monkey beer. And we don't know where monkey beer comes from. Well, that about covers it for this show, MJ.
Great. Well, thanks, Gavin. I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of ZDNet's All About Microsoft.
And I'm Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register. And this has been Microbyte, brought to you by the people who bite the hand that feeds IT.